Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
And welcome to another Word in Your Ear, where our special guest this time, all the way from Los Angeles, California, is Harold Bronson. Hello, Harold.
Hello.
Greetings.
How you doing? And Harold, I mean, we've been trying to work out, we're going to be rude and we're going to ask how old you are, because I think I've worked out you're the same age as I am, Harold, because I've worked out when you left college from your book, Time Has Come Today, Rock and Roll Diaries. So I was born in 1950. What year were you born, Harold?
Same as you, so I'm 73.
All right, there you go. This is perfect, you see.
This is the golden ticket, the absolute golden ticket, to be born in 1950 in Los Angeles and be 15 in 1965, seeing all the acts you saw.
Well, you know, it's so interesting, and, you know, you guys know this, but because the Beatles hit, you know, roughly, you know, early 1974, and so not only were there...
64,
great recordings, but because, you know, there were the ones from 1963 that we hadn't heard yet, and so those were introduced, so you had... You know, certain artists, you know, good one being Freddie and the Dreamers, for instance, you know, that were having hits that were, you know, a year old, you know, because they were hits in Britain. Same thing with, you know, Jerry and the Pacemakers and the Beatles.
Right, right. So the question traditionally we always start off by asking people is if they can remember the record playing machinery that was in your house when you were a child. Can you remember?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It was, you know, it sat on a chest of drawers, but it was a box where you had, you know, you open the lid and, you know, the speaker was in the unit. And, you know, what people don't quite remember, even though people who are familiar with older record players or the concept of record players, is that there were three speeds back then, you know, of course, 45, absolutely, 33, but also 78s.
We had 16 as well.
Sometimes there were four speeds.
A four speed.
16. But anyway, yeah, 78. So what records did your parents have? Can you remember those?
Well, my parents weren't big music fans, but I do remember 78s. When I was really young, they used to play music Sunday mornings, breakfast. My mom would cook breakfast. But, I mean, there were certain records that, you know, later on, L.M.A. Morris, Spike Jones, of course.
Right.
Jane Morgan, I think it was Fascination. Stan Freberg, I got to love Stan Freberg. But again, not necessarily contemporary record buyers, but there were these 78s that we used to play.
Right. Can you remember what you first bought for yourself?
I was really into history, and I think history meant something more back then, because I think after World War II, there was an emphasis of going to safer cultural eras by going back further. So you had a lot of Westerns on TV, as we know. And I loved history. I loved learning about the president's first record, Johnny Horton, The Battle of New Orleans.
Oh, right. Oh. We beat the blooming British in the back.
Right.
We fired our guns and the British kept a coming. And there wasn't as many as there was a while ago.
I could sing it as well. But now, I don't know if you know about this one, but there was a comedic version of that, which, you know, was such a big hit. And it was by Homer and Jethro, who are probably most well known for doing the Beverly Hillbillies theme.
Yes.
I mean, you know, they were bluegrass and country, but they did this thing about, they took the Battle of New Orleans, they called it the Battle of Cucamonga, and it was about, you know, a summer camp, you know, with the boys invading the
world, right.
You know, taking something historical and making silly and mundane. But then the next real record, again, it was really before I started buying records, which came with the Beatles, but it was Brian Hyland, Itsy Bitsy, Teeny Weeny,
huge hit in Britain.
Yeah.
One of the first I remember, too.
Right. So, again, I was, you know, I liked novelty records.
Did you feel very fortunate growing up in Los Angeles in the 60s in terms of the groups you could get to see? Was it, you know, who did you go and see those days?
You talk about seeing Hendrix and Deep Purple, Cream, The Doors, Seeds,
yes.
Wild Man Fisher, The Stones, supported by Tina Turner and Ike. I mean, there must be one of those that really springs to mind as a very warm memory.
Well, you know, as we know, there's certain artists that were, you know, more consistently good, say like Procol Harum. There were other artists who were kind of sloppy and not all that together, like the Kinks, but were highly entertaining. Maybe I saw them 8 or 9 times then. But and then, you know, somebody could have a good night or a bad night. So, for instance, the Doors were notorious for, you know, not being good every night. Or in fact, there's a video, extremely well shot, of the Doors at the Hollywood Bowl. And the frustration of that is it's not a bad performance, but it's just mediocre. You know, there were certain aspects like the Stones at Comeback Tour. So this was one of their first gigs. It was at the Forum, 1969. And, you know, from not having seen the Stones, you know, I'm thinking, you know, some of the songs, you know, back then they weren't necessarily dedicated to sounding like the records. So, you know, when you're a music fan, you're a record fan. If somebody could actually capture what's on the record, I mean, that's what your expectation would be. So, like, for instance, the Turtles were great in part because the harmonies, you know, they were in choir class, they could do the harmonies aside from, you know, other aspects of their showmanship. But then, you know, when you had the Stones and you're hearing Satisfaction, you know, Keith Richards kind of weedy guitar, and it doesn't sound like the saxophone fuzz tone that you hear on the record. So, you know, I'm not saying that I didn't like them, but you kind of had to make adjustments. So the first part of the show, I remember being like, well, wait, when you think about Under My Thumb and you think about Brian Jones's Marimba and you think about the kind of the mystery of the song. And if you remember, or if you saw, you know, the Ready, Steady, Go video, which is great in the way Michael Lindsay Hogg shot that. And then you hear Under My Thumb without the marimba. It's, well, wait a minute, you know, what, Right. By the end of the show, like the last 30, 40 minutes, they really caught fire and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And I was thinking to myself, because the ticket was more than twice as much as any other ticket I paid for. It was $12.50. And I was thinking, yeah, I think it was worth seeing the Stones for $12.50.
So when did you start keeping a kind of log of what you were seeing and doing? You know, these diaries that aren't your books based on, they presumably go back to this time.
Well, it's interesting. Fortunately, my memory's pretty good. It's not photographic. I don't remember everything, but it's pretty good. And during the 70s, when I wrote for Rolling Stone or had access to Rolling Stone, they had the Book of Days, which was, you'd open it up. The left side, there was a photo. The right side was the month with all the little boxes that you could write in what you were doing. After the end of the month, I just tore it out and threw it away because, you know, what do you need that for? So prior to 1980, you know, in the early Rhino days, 1980 onwards, I kept all of my appointment books. So I have all those dates. Everything previous to that, I reconstructed. So certain things right. like concert dates are publicly advertised. You could kind of, you know, okay, here are these dates. Other things I was able to kind of guess or pinpoint. Other things I estimated. But in some cases, where I couldn't really get a fix on a date, I didn't include it as a diary entry. Let me give you an example. There was a press reception for the Incredible String Band. There was a high-end Indian restaurant on Sunset Boulevard called Dharma Greb.
See, we wish we'd been there automatically. Yeah, carry on.
By the way, you know, writers, free food, let alone,
yes.
restaurant like this. The point is I got there early and Robin Williamson, oh, hey, yeah, come on, sit next to me. So I remember, you know, where I sat with him right next to him and I, you know, the evening, but because I couldn't come up with a date, even like close to it, I didn't include that. So I was really trying to be accurate. And the other thing is a lot of this was, to document aspects of rock history. So there's a lot in the book, I guess I should say the title, Time Has Come Today. There's a lot in the book that hasn't been, reported before, documented before. And so I just thought, it's important to kind of get this down, whether it's of interest or in some cases trivial. Like I'll give you one example. I spent some time with Badfinger. This was, in February 1972, I got to know them the previous year because that was my first assignment for Rolling Stone, was interviewing them. But anyway, there was a press reception for them while they were playing the Whiskey a Go-Go here at the Black Rabbit Inn on Melrose. And so I put that in there and, you know, it's noted, but, you know, that's trivial, but it's not anywhere else because it was just, you know, it wasn't really documented. It was a press party. It wasn't publicly advertised. So, you know, there's aspects of that I'm trying to, like, you know, put things in that I think, you know, people should know about.
You just mentioned about writing for Rolling Stone and you interviewed all sorts of, again, really interesting people. There was an interview with the members of the Pink Floyd and Van Dyke Parks. Fantastic interview with Ozzy Osbourne, where you say it's the first person I've ever met who had tattoos, and the Bee Gees and Mickey Most and Nicky Hopkins. Can you remember any particular interviews that really stand out that were a real revelation?
Well, let's talk about Ozzy.
Yeah.
So we know that that you're a fan of an artist, and you know you want to find out more, and you can interview them, and so you're coming to that with an interest and a passion. And then there's others that, you know, are kind of assignments that, okay, well, it's part of the job. I'll do it. I'm not that interested, which for me, I tried to keep it a minimum as a freelance writer, as a non-staff writer. And then there were others in the middle, like with Black Sabbath. I mean, I had the second album, the Paranoid album. And, but it was like the end of the school year. I'd done my finals. The call came into the Daily Bruin office. It was kind of like in the middle. It was like, okay. So what's interesting, they were renting a house north of UCLA in Bel Air. And it was owned by this guy, John DuPont, who was an heir to the DuPont, you know, chemical fortune, who years later became really notorious. There was a movie called Foxcatcher that Steve Carell starred, where John DuPont was really into wrestling and wrestling coach. And there's like he murdered a wrestler, and it's in the movie, but obviously, you know, people didn't know that side of things, but he owned the house that they rented. And I met Ozzy by the pool house, and he was like, you know, his long, lank hair, you know, dripping water, and his, you know, swim trunks. And I just really liked him. So, you know, many revelations. You think about heavy metal, serious, you think all of that. And, you know, he was like kind of, you know, a fun, you know, engaging guy. But he tells me about how he was like such a big Beatles fan. And you don't think of Ozzy Osbourne growing up with Beatles pictures on his wall, dreaming that hoping that his sister would marry one of the Beatles. And then, you know, when you think about roots, his roots are Black Sabbath. He was talking about, well, the Kinks, You Really Got Me, which, well, that makes sense. But then he goes, you know, the Trogs, Wild Thing. And he starts singing the song to me. So anyway, I mean, it was very memorable. I think, you know, he liked me. He invited me to the recording session that evening at the record plant, which was in kind of south of Hollywood on 3rd Street. And again, just write about this in the book about he had a hardcover book that he wrote his lyrics in, or maybe I think they were whether his or Geezer Butler's lyrics. And he was singing from the book like this, but he was, you know, stoned on something. And he was singing a bit flat. You know, he was double tracking his vocal. So, obviously that's really memorable. I'll just give you like one other one. When I went to London the first time, this was in the end of the summer, 1972, I had like, who do I want to interview who never comes to Los Angeles? So, you know, Paul Jones, who was not happening then, but a big Manfred Mann fan. And so, you know, I had a few people like that, but Mickey Most, you know, I loved his production with, you know, Herman's Hermits and Donovan and the Animals and some of the other artists. So I met him at RAC, and I thought he was really candid, and it was a little intense, almost like a therapy session, because he starts, you know, ragging on artists and how, you know, they borrow money from you, they never pay you back, you know, they enjoy spending time with you on your yacht. And then he reads in the paper, you know, when Lulu says she's looking for a new producer, and he was like frustrated, I made her the number one, you know, girl singer, and I read in the paper. And he talks about you know, Jeff Beck, and how that Mickey wanted to sign Rod Stewart, and Jeff said, oh, you can't do that, you know, it'd be, you know, competitive, you're looking after me. So it's like really revealing. So again, that's you know, that's in the book. And
and very revealing about his relationship with the Animals. The Animals saying that they'd split from him because they thought that they were getting paid too little.
Yeah, well, I mean you know, it was very unsophisticated then. And you know, royalties, I mean, how would you really know what royalties were?
No, you wouldn't know. You wouldn't know. So, but also, Hilton, yeah. Tell us about Hilton
Valentine. I love the bit that follows. Yes, is that you meet Hilton Valentine, yeah, in Hollywood, don't you? Who had been the original lead guitarist in the Animals. Carry on. Go on.
Okay, so my 72 visit to London, I'd done maybe two or three things for Melody Maker. So I met with Ray Coleman, who I liked a lot, you know, really charming. And House of the Rising Sun was, you know, coming back into the UK charts. So he assigned me to track down Hilton Valentine, write up a story, which I did, which, you know, appeared in Melody Maker. But he was living south of the Whiskey Go-Go, south of Sunset Boulevard on one of the streets in a rented a duplex, rented apartment. And again, you know, when you're a young music fan, you have certain expectations and you think the Animals, they had all these hits. You don't really know the business of whether they made money or they didn't make money. And I'm looking at this place, you know, which is a modest place. His roommate was Barry Jenkins, who had been the, you know, second drummer after John Steele. But I really like Hilton a lot. I was smoking marijuana from like a flat disc. So, you know, and my hair was, and I was like, you know, and then a little bit later I'm smelling something. I'd singed my hair. It was like, you know, brown. Couple of things he said, you know, he said that he blew his money. I guess he alluded to drinking a lot. He was into Nishrin Shoshu Buddhism, and it was like, oh, you got to come to a meeting. And I liked Hilton so much that I think a week or two later, I did go to a meeting, and he wasn't there. And I stayed a little while, but it wasn't for me, so I split. And the other thing is, he gave me a copy, a reel-to-reel copy. I think his new band, Ujar Kapiv, was, I think, maybe the first signing of RSO Records, Robert Stigwood organization. And I remember he mentioned a couple people who were in, Stan Harris from the new Vaudeville band. Anyway, I actually still have that reel to reel. Never came out. I thought it was pretty good, but it never came.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Yeah.
Wasn't he also working in a Henry VIII themed restaurant in Los Angeles?
Yes. Thank you for mentioning that.
We love that detail.
Yeah, it was like La Cienega was called Restaurant Row. And it was, you know, really the early stages of themed restaurants. And it was, yeah, a Henry VIII themed restaurant. Yeah. My budget didn't permit me, you know, to actually have a meal there. So I never went in, but it was, you know, where they dressed up. I think he was the manager of that. Again, yeah. You know, Hilton Valentine.
Extraordinary.
All the stories about the kind of record launches you went to are so kind of nostalgic because, you know, the amount of money that was around at the time. There was a Gary Glitter launch you went to, and I think it was attended by... And Gary Glitter, I don't think anyone talked to him, but Alice Cooper was there, Groucho Marx, Donovan, Mickey Dolenz, Alan Price and Dustin Hoffman. I mean, that's a pretty good catch, isn't it, in one room?
You know, I remember because he was dressed, you know, in white and, you know, the glittery and the big shoes and all of that stuff. But they didn't take him around or introducing him to anybody. So, you know, it was at this banquet hall. And, you know, again, you know, writers, you know, and meals. But, you know, Gary Glitter. And, you know, it's kind of like it almost seemed like a waste of money if you, you know, somebody who was just merely there.
Well, if people are at a launch, they don't realize what the launch is for. It's not quite working, is it?
Well, I saw that, I think, with, you know, I talk about Led Zeppelin's Swan Song.
Yeah.
Which was the launch of that at the Bel Air Hotel. And Groucho Marx was there, and he looked a bit, you know, befuddled, like, why am I here and who are these people? And Maggie Bell approached him. I have the whole thing in the book. Maggie Bell approached him and goes, oh, you know, I'm such a big fan. She's really complimentary. And he goes, fuck that. Show us your tits. So that was, you know, Groucho.
That's the 70s.
Hashtag different time.
And by the way, you know, I do mention a number of these parties, obviously not everyone, but then, you know, you'd see Ron and Russell Mayall, you know, kind of at all of these, you know, again, probably, you know, snoring for the free food. And then I think at the Alice Cooper Bicentennial, Ben Edmonds told me that I think they absconded with a whole pie.
Tell us about Rhino Records, which is another part of your CV, because it's a very famous record shop in Los Angeles. Is it still there? I don't know, it probably isn't.
No, it went to buy, unfortunately. Okay, so here's the thing. You know, if you're a record fan, on some level, you know, there's kind of like, wow, wouldn't it be great to work in a record store? You know, because you're with the music you love and it seems like it's, you know, it's not going to be that, you know, physically imposing. And when I got out of UCLA, I thought I had the credentials to get a job working for a major label. My last year at UCLA, I was a college rep for Columbia Records. I was writing for Rolling Stone and Rock Magazine and some of the other magazines. And, you know, I was doing, I thought, a really great job. For however I presented myself, that didn't happen. So at a certain point, I was friendly with the owner of the Rhino store, which opened in October 1973. And in April, the following April, I was able to get work there. But I never wanted, that wasn't to be my life's work. I really wanted to work at a label, but I thought I needed to pay my bills. And anyway, the long and short of it, after a couple of years, I became manager. And then when I was at UCLA, I had a band and really ahead of the curve produced my own records. I realized that you could go to a local pressing plant, it just as soon take your money as taking money from a more established company. So I did two singles and an album. And again, this was a few years before the later on in the 70s, the DIY thing.
Yeah.
So I said to Richard, I know how to do this. Let's start a label from the back room of the store. But again, it was just a lark. It was just for fun. It wasn't initially thought to be a real business. But then in 1978, which I look upon as really the first year of our label, because that's when we started to put out albums. And we did pretty well to the point where at the end of that year, Richard sold the store. Years later, we bought back into it, but that's a different story. So, and then in January 1979, we went into our own location, you know, focusing on the label.
And then how important a part of that was reissues? Because reissues is what Rhino is most associated with, certainly in the UK.
Okay, so originally it was the novelty records, you know, which I mentioned because we could record them cheaply. Then I was a real proponent of local bands. And for the, early few years, the frustration is even recording EPs of, you know, the better bands that had followings that local radio, like KROQ, K-Rock, they wouldn't play them. So, you know, without the airplay, they wouldn't sell, and we lost money on most of them. Very frustrating, very disheartening, because, you know, you believe in these artists and you just, you know, you want to, you know, give them a leg up, and it just, you know, it just didn't happen. In our first year, the only sort of reissue we did was picture discs were in. And I was friendly with Howard Kalin, Mark Volman, Flo and Eddie, you know, who'd been in the Turtles. We put out a Turtles picture disc, which is like really great looking and great photos. Three of the four cuts were unreleased. It was like when they were in psychedelia and they were like, you know, throwing everything in, including the kitchen sink. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of like didn't work. But so they had these tracks, and that kind of started it. And then again, Novelty Records, big Alan Sherman fans, who, for people who are unfamiliar, was kind of like similar to what Weird Al Yankovic became.
Oh, it's Hello Mother, Hello Father.
Yeah. So we put the first reissue was the Best of Alan Sherman, and that there was no Best of. That did really well. But let me tell you, the first rock reissue, which were done for our perverse reasons. Okay, the Barbarians were a group out of Boston, out of Boston, really obscure, except for two things. There was one track by the Barbarians on the original Nuggets album, so people would kind of know them from then. And then for people who had seen the Tammy show, they were the only unknown group in the Tammy show. Okay, so after a Rolling Stones tour, Ron Wood, Keith Richards still wanted to play the New Barbarians tour. Yes, no record on the New Barbarians. Let's license the original Barbarians. Let's put it out. Maybe some people be confused and they'll buy our record instead. That's where we were coming from. So even though we did a good job in making it sound good and, you know, the cover and everything, you know, there was our humor in it. So I wrote the liner notes in the guise, you know, like a lot of, in my mind, a lot of, you know, European, you know, fans are like, you know, have the wrong interpretations or they're overly enthusiastic. So I kind of wrote it in the guise of this guy. And I called up my friend Peter Noon. I said, look, I'm writing this from somebody, you know, who lives in Luxembourg, like the Barbarians fan club, you know, in Luxembourg, as if. And he gave me the name of, oh yeah, who would be somebody who lives in Luxembourg? So he gave me this name, Joe Doisy. So I put that as, you know, who wrote the liner. So what I'm saying is that, you know, it was like really kind of perverse fun, you know, let's have a fun with this. It ended up selling 6,000 record albums, which was profitable. The first proper best of was our Best of Love. And that started a long relationship I had with Arthur Lee over 20 years doing projects. I did a solo album.
You re-promoted Forever Changes, didn't you?
Yes, I had a really good relationship with Arthur. Yeah. It wasn't an easy relationship, but I just loved his music so much. And Forever Changes is one of my favorite albums that, you know, I just felt that he...
But just getting back to the reissues just for a second. David and I were talking about this. We thought the first box set reissue that we could really remember was Biograph, but you were pretty much started that idea of getting back catalog and unreleased material and stuff and repackaging it for, as a top end product, right?
Yes. Okay. So the roots of that was so when we had the record store and we would take notice, you know, what was out, but also, you know, imports. It might have been a Bear family. You know, Germany, I think it was Gene Vincent, you know, taking note of a box set. So we put out the first rock box set in the U.S., and it was with Ritchie Valens and three discs. What's interesting is that the third disc, which came out originally, was a live album, live at Pacoima Junior High, because he never graduated high school. So Pacoima, which is an area in East Los Angeles where he was from, It was a concert. It was recorded on a dictaphone. Now, a dictaphone is what was used in offices for, you know, executives to, you know, take a letter and giving it to their secretary and have her type it. So it was a dictaphone that, anyway, so Ritchie Valens' albums were long out of print. So that was a three-record box set. For the booklet, we got... We tracked down, we went to Pacoima Junior High, got a photo of him from the yearbook, but we also included photos from the crash site, you know, with who was also, you know, the Big Bopper and Buddy Holly were in the plane. Those photos, I don't think were ever printed before because in 1959, it was thought to be bad taste. See a field with like a body in it like that. So that was in part of the, you know, the book. So basically, you know, we really, on that and all the packages, we really tried to do a great job because we were record fans and we thought, let's treat this with the same appreciation and respect that we felt as, you know, this music and the artist who created it, you know, did to us. That contrasted with the industry where a lot of this material, if it was even available, it was how do we squeeze this out and spend the least amount of money? So, you know, that was, I think, part of our success was, you know, just recognizing it, you know, just from our own values.
Yeah, because that's the thing that's really changed, hasn't it, over the last, I suppose, 40 years, is that back catalogue used to mean cheap, really, generally speaking. And nowadays, back catalog means expensive, doesn't it? It's premium priced. People like spending a lot of money on this stuff, don't they?
Well, you also have to think one reason for it is because the market is a lot less, whether it's for vinyl LP buyers or CD buyers. So it's almost like if there's a really good compilation, you almost... You know, if you're interested, you almost have to cherish it and appreciate it because, you know, there's a lot fewer coming out now than there were 20, 30 years ago.
Right, right. But people like, you know, it always amuses me when you look on the internet and people unboxing the latest, you know, reissue of whatever, you know. Peeling away the shrink wrap. People just love that stuff.
It's a sort of fetishistic thing now, isn't it?
It is.
You know,
it's kind of pornography.
I think that started with YouTube, maybe like with toys, where like, oh, I got a new toy in the box. I think that's probably. Yeah. But, you know, if you're interested, it's better to kind of see it unfolding that way rather than just to see the sealed box and the shrink wrap.
I loved your line in the book, sooner or later, everyone ends up in a box. Were there any of those repackages that you were particularly pleased with? Just did particularly well and you felt very, you know,
well, gratified? You know, so many from an artistic point of view, like when we reissued the Ruddles on CD. So again, it was originally on this elaborately vinyl package and, of course, cassette. But... our ace sound guy, Bill Inglot, in the vaults found that I think there were 14 songs originally on the original, you know, vinyl, but there were 6 songs that were in the TV special that were not. So by doing the 20-track CD, we were giving fans something that they couldn't get otherwise. So those were the types of things that I really liked. When we reissued the early Everly Brothers, which were on Barnaby, and they sounded really good. And then I'd found out that the original masters that we used, the first generation masters, hadn't been used before. They were all second or third generation. You know, they would make copies and send it to this pressing plant. So the Bo Brummels, when we reissued that again, it sounded better than it ever had been before. In the U.S., the original Yardbirds Greatest Hits that Epic Records had put out was electronically reprocessed. So when we put out our best of, you know, it sounded great. I contacted Dezo Hoffman and, you know, picked out a photo of his for the cover and, you know, really good liner notes. There's so many things, but let me tell you again, you know, we had this, you know, we were highly creative. We had this perverse side and humor that we needed to express. We had a particularly good year. I think this is 1982. So, there were radio shows that played Louie Louie, like all the versions back to back, college radio stations. And we thought, well, you know, a best of album is an artist's, you know, their best, their hits, their best tracks. Nobody had done a best of one song. So we did the best of Louie Louie, 10 tracks. We made it budget price. And this was like our joke. Like, ha, 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 best of Louie Louie. Oh, but it's one song. Budget price, we thought, okay, if we sell 3,000, we'll break even, right? It's a shock. We sold over 100,000.
Wow.
So every once in a while, you would do something. You would think, oh, you know, we just want to do this out. Or like, for instance, again in the U.S., I was a big fan of the Bonzo Dog Band and also the Tremolos. So I put out, you know, best of CDs, you know, not thinking that they were going to sell, but, you know, each of them did over 10,000. So they made money. So a lot of what we did was it was for the music. And in a lot of cases, it was, well, this should be out. The spring album, Marilyn Wilson, Diane Ravel, Brian Wilson produced it. You know, this should be out, but you know, even if we lose money, and in many cases we actually made money, so that was pleasing.
Well, look, there's the book. Time Has Come Today. Have you got a copy of it in front of you that you can wave at the camera, Harold?
I wish I did, but I don't. I should.
By Harold Bronson, Rock and Roll Diaries, 1967 to 2007. Can be, I'm sure you can find your way to a copy one way or another via the miracle of the internet or whatever. Is it coming out in paperback soon, I think you said? Is that right?
Yeah, so it's hardcover and an ebook. You know, online you can get it, you know, usual places. If a bookstore doesn't have it, they could easily order it. And I believe the end of May, the trade paperback version is coming out.
Right. Well, look, it's been nice to talk to you. Forgive us for getting you up so early in Los Angeles. Go back to bed.
Take the rest of the day off.
That's what I would
do. Your work is done. Thanks very much, Harold.
Okay.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.